It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Amazon is offering one-day delivery to a growing list of communities, but our guest says the convenience may come with a cost. First, the number of Americans who identify as having no religion is getting bigger over the years. It's been trending that way for quite a while now. In the 1980s, less than 10% said they didn't belong to a religion. Today, that number hovers over 20%. Our next guest says if these trends continue, no religion could be the biggest religious affiliation in America in a decade. Ryan Burge is an assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University. He focuses on the intersection of religion and political behavior. He's also senior pastor of the First Baptist Church in Mount Vernon, Illinois. Ryan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
Before we get to these projections for the future, can you spell out some of the biggest trends we've seen when it comes to religion in the United States in recent years?
Well, yeah, the biggest trend, obviously, is the rise of what we call the nones, the N-O-N-E-S. Those are people who say on surveys that they have no religious affiliation. That's typically made up of three groups. Atheists are people who say that there is no God. Agnostics are people who say that there might be a God, but there's no way for us to find out. And there's this third group that's interesting, called the nothing in particular group, and they're the kind of people who just, when they are asked the religion question on surveys, just sort of shrug their shoulders and say none of the above. And interestingly enough, they're about 20% of Americans say that they have no religious affiliation in particular. Atheists are about 5%, agnostics are about 5% as well.
And Ryan, you recently tried to project out into the future to see what things might look like in 2030. And I want to say up front, you know, sometimes people make these bold, confident predictions that this is how things will be. This is not what you're doing. You're just looking at current trends and kind of seeing how things would play out if we continue more or less on the same path. Can you talk about what you did?
Yeah, so I used a survey called the General Social Survey. It's sort of the gold standard of people who study religion in American society because it's asked the same religion questions in the same way biannually since 1972. The sample size is typically between 2,500 and 3,000 per wave, so a pretty good sample size. And the real winner here is because it's got this consistency over time. It hasn't changed the way it asked religion questions. So we divide American religion up into seven different categories. That is evangelical Protestants, mainline Protestants, black Protestants, Catholics, Jews, people of other faith traditions, and then people who have no religious affiliation. And, you know, I've been tracking these trends over the last 10 years or so in terms of what groups are growing in size and what groups are getting smaller in size. And obviously, like we just talked about, the growth in no religion has been sort of meteoric and exponential over the last 20 years or so. And so I constantly would get asked these questions by people, and they see my charts. They say, okay, but what does American religion look like in 10 years or in 20 years, you know? And I didn't have a good answer to that, a good statistical answer to that. So I wanted to do like a really simple exercise where I basically just shot a line through each trend for each of the seven groups from 1980 into 2030. So just about 11 years into the future to see what they would look like. Because really what I was looking at is the question I always get asked are, when are nuns going to be the largest group in America? And according to this very, very simple model, it looks like 2029 will be the year when we can conclusively say that the religiously unaffiliated will be larger than Catholics or evangelicals and will clearly be the largest religious group in America.
Now, the key there is if current trends continue, that'll happen. But some people point, and you write about this in your piece projecting here, sometimes American religion moves and fits and starts. We have these great awakenings where people flock to a new faith or congregation or renew their faith. That is something that could happen potentially over the next 11 years.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there could be things that happen either direction, right? We could see, a lot of evangelicals pray for revival, and they pray for like the third great awakening or the fourth great awakening, depending on how you want to count it, right? If that happens, then this model falls apart. I mentioned if we have like a 9/11 type event, this model might fall apart again as well. So, you know, it's prediction is a terribly difficult business because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, let alone 5 years from now. This is assuming that everything that's happened from 1980 to 2018 will continue apace into the next 10 or 11 years.
Talking to Ryan Burge, assistant professor of political science at Eastern Illinois University. He looks at the intersection of religion and political behavior. In a recent exercise, he projected out current religious trends in the United States up to 2030. Ryan, what, and I know there are arguments about this, what do we see driving this rise of, again, the nuns, the people who say they don't affiliate with a particular religious group?
Yeah, so that's a super complex question, right? I mean, there's many things that get kind of stirred into the pot when we talk about what makes people become unaffiliated. And there's, I'll give you the highlights. One is what's called secularization theory, which is this old theory in social science that argues that as a country becomes more economically prosperous and people gain higher levels of education, a natural conclusion of that is they will sort of cast off religion because they don't need it anymore. And the evidence of that would be Europe. I mean, most European countries now are post-Christian in a lot of ways, especially like in Scandinavian, Northern European countries. About 10 or 15% of people attend church every week. So maybe what's happening in America is, as we're getting more economically prosperous, where we're getting higher levels of education, that we're sort of casting off religion. Just we're doing it slower than Europe did. We're sort of 30 or 40 years behind Europe. That's one theory. Another theory that I sort of like is that people are just being honest on surveys now when they used to lie. You know, because it just used to be culturally unacceptable to be religiously unaffiliated. You know, before the internet, if you were, an atheist in rural Mississippi, you would probably never tell anyone you were an atheist in rural Mississippi because you'd be ostracized, right? Because it's a predominantly Christian area. So the internet has allowed people to find other rural atheists in Mississippi, and they don't feel like they're alone anymore. And I feel like it's kind of a thing where as more and more people came out and said, listen, I'm atheist, I'm agnostic, it sort of gave permission for people who were more reluctant to say, you know what, I am too. So maybe what we're seeing here is not really more and more people are disaffiliating. What we might actually be seeing is more and more people are just being honest when we ask them the survey questions.
Another thought is that we've seen sociology research that says, hey, Americans are joining stuff less than they used to, whether that thing is a bowling league or the Rotary or whatever it might be. Is a similar thing going on with religion? Not necessarily we're becoming less spiritual, we're just not joiners anymore?
Yeah, so you're referencing, that's a great reference, a book called Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam, a book that argues that it was written in the 1990s, and basically Putnam argues that we're joining stuff less, like you talk about the Rotary, and we're not bowling in bowling leagues anymore, we're bowling by ourselves. And, you know, he lays that at the feet of cable television, because it was 1994, you know, what else did you have? And so I would argue that now we Facebook alone, and we tweet alone, and we Instagram alone, you know, it's sort of cable television to the 10th power with social media and with Netflix and with streaming and everything else. It's become so much easier now as a modern American to be socially isolated than it was even 20 or 30 years ago. And I think what's happened with church attendance, it's sort of gotten caught up in this wave of social isolation where it's not just church attendance by itself. It's just social isolation in all aspects of life, not just in the religious sphere.
Is there a generational divide in our religious affiliation? Do we see, for example, more millennials and Generation Z people likely to identify as not being affiliated with a religion?
Yeah, so every successive generation is less religious than the prior generation before them. And that's been consistent basically for the last 50 years or so. The thing that makes that difficult, though, is, and a lot of people want to ask me about like Gen Z, are they even more religious? And the answer is yes, they actually are. Almost 40% of them say they have no religious affiliation. But the problem is that we know that if you ask a 22-year-old, their religiosity is going to be low anyway because they're in college, they're sort of figuring things out, sowing their wild oats and moving around and, you know, all the things that happen in your late teens and early 20s. What really we care about is what is their religion like when they hit like 35, when they get married, when they have kids, when they settle down, because we would expect them to return to church at some level when they reach their mid-30s. If they don't, then we can say that, wow, we're really, trending in a more religiously unaffiliated direction now. But obviously we can't, you know, predict what they're going to do 15 years down the line.
Do we know, if I could phrase this right, how a Generation Z person at age X, say 25, compares to a millennial at age 25 compares to Generation X and boomers at that same age?
Yeah, so the what I always say is the Y-intercept has gone down. You're right. We're dropping farther. The baseline is dropping farther and farther in terms of religious attendance, which means that every successive generation, at every successive step of their life course, is attending less than the prior generation did. Right. So a 35-year-old who was 35 in 1980 attended more than a 35-year-old in 2000. So every 35-year-old generation is going down the ladder. This is called age period cohort relationships. What we do know is that every generation starts lower and stays lower throughout the entire life course. So there's definitely, I mean, all that data points to this rise of the nuns not slowing down and even potentially accelerating to a level where, I mean, it's very likely by 2035 or 2040, a third of all Americans could be religiously unaffiliated.
Talking to Ryan Burge from Eastern Illinois University about the future of religion in the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're a person of faith yourself, someone who does identify with a particular religious group, how have you seen your religious community change over the years? Does it seem like it gets harder and harder to bring the young people in or to bring them back as they get into their 30s? If you're someone who is part of that none, N-O-N-E category, what's your story? Why have you chosen not to be affiliated with a religious group? Are you an atheist or agnostic, or do you consider yourself spiritual but not connected to a particular, say, congregation? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our talk with Ryan Burge, an expert on religion and political behavior at Eastern Illinois University. We're talking about what religion in America might be like in about a decade, 2030 or so, what the trends are. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. The big story over the past couple decades, and maybe the next one too, the rise of people who say they're not affiliated with any particular religion for whatever reason. Is that you? Are you one of the so-called nuns, or are you a person of faith? Did you leave for a while and then come back, or have you seen your congregation change age over the years? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Corey is with us in Harmony, Minnesota. Corey, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Corey?
I was just calling to put my input. I am actually 30, almost 31, and I quit going for a long time, but now I have brought my children back into it, and I was baptized Catholic, confirmed Methodist, and now I actually attend a Baptist church.
Corey, thanks. And if I may ask, do you want to talk about why you were away from the congregations for a while?
It didn't matter to me or to my ex, and I was more willing to go, but he didn't want to, so then I just never went, and now I'm glad that I have someone that is willing to go with me, and we go with his grandparents, and we even have a Sunday school for adults and Sunday school for children, and then we all get together for the actual service.
Corey, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. Ryan, you'd mentioned that to this case where often people might go away in their upper teens and 20s, but then come back, especially when there are kids involved.
Yeah, no, Corey's a great example of what we were talking about. It's called the life cycle effect, right? It's like sort of people sort of calm down, they get to their 30s. But what's more interesting to me about Corey's story is it sort of reflects what we know about how people are shifting around the religious ecosystem, right? So she said she started as Catholic, but then she became Methodist, but then she became Baptist. And that transition is really Catholic to mainline Protestant, which is like the more moderate flavor of Protestant Christianity, to Baptist, which is probably Southern Baptist, which is more evangelical or more conservative forms of Christianity. What's interesting is mainline Protestants were the largest religious tradition in America in 1976. 30% of all Americans were mainline Protestants in 1976. Today, it's 10%. So we've lost that sort of moderate Protestantism, and people are more evangelicals have basically held steady for the last 15 or 20 years. And in Corey's story, you can see that she became more of an evangelical and sort of walked away both from Catholicism and from mainline Protestant Christianity.
Thanks for that call. And Ryan, for huge parts of Christian history, the distinction between a Catholic and a Protestant or a Methodist or a Baptist, I mean, at some points it might be something you'd kill somebody over. At some points you'd have really detailed arguments about the differences in doctrine. that just doesn't seem to be a thing in the United States so much anymore.
Yeah, I think the big, it used to be, I mean, 50 years ago, it was definitely Catholic versus Protestant, right? Especially, you know, anti-papal language, a lot of discrimination that way. And it was also tied up with immigration, too, because a lot of immigrants to this country came from Catholic, predominantly Catholic countries like Europe and Central and South America. I would argue that the major conflict in American religion today is not Catholic versus Protestant. It's actually Christianity versus Islam, especially with the war on terror and all the things that are tied up with that. I think and this has sort of faded a little bit more recently, but definitely, you know, during the George W. Bush years, even the Obama years, there's a lot of anti-Muslim rhetoric in America. So the common enemy for Americans became Muslims. It wasn't Catholic Protestant anymore.
Let's go back to our callers now. Chris is with us in Stevens Point. Chris, hi.
Hi. I'm calling. I'm 31, so I'm kind of right in the middle of the millennials. I was raised a nun. My parents were raised Catholic, but they kind of left the church, and they just kind of left it open for us. And when I got to college, I had a lot of discussion with religious friends, Christian friends, and they were always trying to get me to, you know, come on over. And after, you know, many conversations, I was actually pushed away from really religion in general, because it always came down to this need, well, you have to go to church, you know, and who's going to save you if you don't go to church? And I just never really bought it. I mean, I can be a good person without ascribing that goodness to a higher power.
Chris, thanks for sharing your story. Ryan, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, I was just looking at some survey data that talked about perceptions of evangelicals, and one of the things that people really admire about evangelicals is they're people of who have strong and consistent beliefs, but the one thing they don't like about evangelicals is they can be too pushy. You know, so it's like this weird sort of contradiction, right, where like we like the fact that people have these strong beliefs, but we're very reluctant when they try to push those beliefs on us or try to evangelize us. So, you know, America has this very interesting relationship with religion where they're totally fine with people being people of belief. They just don't want to be pressed upon by those people of belief.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Ryan Burge from Eastern Illinois University, looking at the changing face of religion in the United States. We heard on Facebook from Cody, who says it's sad to him that religions are changing who they are to chase public opinion. What do you think of that idea, Ryan?
Well, I mean, I would actually argue I don't think that's happening, because like I talked about, evangelicalism in America has not changed what it is. It's been consistently conservative for the last 50 years at least, and it's actually doing relatively well in American society. There's still about 22% of Americans. They're actually larger today than they were in 1972. The kind of religion in America that's declining is the moderate religion, the mainline religion, the one I was talking about. I'm actually an American Baptist, which is a mainline Protestant church. We allow women pastors. Some churches affirm LGBT lifestyles. And we're the kind of churches that are declining the most rapidly. We've gone from 30% to 10% in the last 30 years or so, and we are on a trajectory to be less than 5% in 10 years. So, I mean, the churches that aren't changing are actually doing very, very well in modern society. It's the middle that's sort of being hollowed out. We're seeing religious polarization like we're seeing political polarization.
Let's bring on another caller. Kylie is with us in Sparta. Kylie, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Kylie?
So I'm 40. Oh, I feel old. Okay. I was lucky and was raised in the Congregational United Church of Christ. And we, our denomination is, you know, no matter like who you are or where you're coming from, like you're always welcome in our church. Like, that's the denomination. The church in my town, through the years, hasn't changed all that much with the denomination. So it's a little more conservative. The church, my personal church, a little more conservative than the denomination itself is. Mm-hmm. And in the last few years, I have not been attending church like I used to, but God has still never left me. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I just don't go to church as much as I used to, but, you know,
we don't have too much time left. Thank you for that call. So, Ryan, I hear Kylie's not moved away from her faith at all, but her particular congregation isn't bringing her into the pews as much as it used to.
Yeah, that's the issue with every denomination, though, right? I mean, how much control can you really have over what the local church does? And in a lot of denominations, like Baptist, for instance, it's all local church autonomy. Each church can decide what it wants to do at the individual church level in terms of doctrine, theology, and everything else. And there's really not a lot the national denomination can do to force you to go one direction or the other. So that's the hard thing about studying American religion. When I talk about United Methodists, there's 30,000 congregations, and they're all different in their own unique way.
And Ryan, we've heard from some people who, have been in and out a little bit over their lives, and we hear a lot about young people in churches. Is there a sense for young people that churches are talking to them, that denominations are talking to them, and keeping up with whatever their unique generational needs are?
Every church is obsessed with trying to bring in the next generation. You know, like church growth is an entire industry. It's probably hundreds of millions of dollars in literature and conferences and workshops and everything else. And the problem that evangelicals are struggling with is they want to be consistent with their theology, which is conservative, especially on issues like LGBT issues or the environment or social justice. The problem is, though, that we know that younger and younger Americans are overwhelmingly in favor of gay marriage, like 75-80% of young people, and even a majority of young evangelicals are in favor of gay marriage. So at some point, how do they stay doctrinally orthodox but also be attractive to this next generation that finds some of their positions to be too far to the right and too conservative for the changing society? So that's a tough nut to crack, right, to try to be both things at one time.
In our last couple of minutes, again, you project this out to 2030, but things can change. What are some of the next pieces of evidence you're watching out for?
So the things that I am thinking about a lot are the changing racial demographics of America, right? We know that, I mean, the Census Bureau projects this, that white people will not be the majority of Americans somewhere in the next 25 or 30 years. What that means for American religion is a lot of things. For instance, the Catholic Church, which used to be 95% white, is now only 75% white, right? So if more and more Hispanics come to America and bring their Catholicism to America, that means the Catholic Church in America is going to have to become more racially diverse, which means it might have to become more theologically diverse. White evangelicalism is in danger because white people are declining as a share of the population. That's a big thing that I think about. Also with immigration, though, people are immigrating here not just from predominantly Catholic countries. We're seeing a lot of immigration from Southeast Asian countries, places that are Hindu or Buddhist or Muslim. And so we might see that segment of American society grow much more than what we're seeing right now, because a lot of those groups are less than 1% of Americans today. But imagine a future where, if you add Hindus, Muslims, and Buddhists together, they make up 8 or 9% of Americans. That's the same size as black Protestants are today. I mean, they would become a significant social and political force in America. So there's all this demography that's going on. And then the other thing is the baby boomers are going to die off in the next 15 to 20 years, and they're going to have to be replaced by the next generation, which is less religious than they are. So all this kind of ties together.
Ryan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Pleasure.
That's Ryan Burge, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Eastern Illinois University, looking at the future of religion and belief in the United States. People with Amazon Prime accounts may have gotten used already to two-day shipping as a speedy regular offering. Amazon made an even bigger promise this spring, one-day shipping to all Prime members, no minimum purchase required. You might even already be using it, depending on where you live. Amazon has predicted they'll spend $800 million making this happen, and involves a lot of details from who's making the deliveries to keeping warehouses stocked. But there are concerns about what the plan could mean for workers and the environment. Louise Matsakis is a journalist reporting on technology and the internet. She's a staff writer at Wired and an on-air contributor at CBS News. Louise, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us what the current state of the art is when it comes to one-day delivery. Where is Amazon on that?
So there are already millions of products that a lot of consumers across the country can get in one day or less, and it's something that's actually more recent. So Amazon originally announced that in April, but more recently they've said that you can even get one-day shipping on something like a toothbrush or, a bottle of shampoo. So it's these items that you might get at CVS or Target or your local retailer. So Amazon's really going after these smaller retailers and these really small items. So it's not just a bigger item that you might get in one day or less. It's that really small thing that you might have gotten on your way home from work or something like that.
What are the challenges people are pointing to in making this a reality for Amazon?
So Amazon's argument is that this is actually better for the environment because the distance from a warehouse to your house has to be relatively short. But critics say that it's actually worse for the environment because you can get, you know, 10 packages a week. There's no incentive for consumers to consolidate their purchases. So there's a lot of cardboard, you know, that truck has to go to your house every day instead of maybe just once a week or once a month or something like that. There's also the pressure on these drivers, most of whom are contractors or they work for something like UPS. So they're not directly employed by Amazon, so Amazon doesn't have that liability, but they're putting all this pressure on these delivery drivers to deliver millions of packages a day. And that puts pressure not on just the drivers, but also on the infrastructure of cities. So that's a lot more traffic, maybe, that's congestion, that's an apartment building lobby being filled with packages that they don't know what to do with. There's all sorts of kind of problems that arise because of this that Amazon can't actually fix even. They're putting pressure on systems outside of their control.
To the point about the environment, I've read that some Amazon workers have even raised concerns in recent months about Amazon's impact on the environment. Is the company feeling pressure on this from outside and inside?
Definitely, yeah. So I broke the story earlier this fall that Amazon workers actually walked out for the first time in the company's history at their headquarters in Seattle over concerns about climate change. You know, unlike Google or Facebook or these other tech giants, Amazon primarily deals in logistics. So they have an incredibly high negative impact on the environment. And they've been historically very secretive about the actual numbers there, about what their carbon impact was. So employees started saying, you know, we don't agree with this. So they banded together and they actually, in offices across the world, but primarily in Seattle, walked out. They went on strike to say, you know, Jeff Bezos, we want you to do more because climate change is real.
Talking to Louise Matsakis from Wired about Amazon's move toward more and more items being available for one-day delivery in a growing number of parts of the country and some of the unintended consequences of that. Louise, talk more about the pressure on, you mentioned the drivers here. People have raised concerns about the pressure and the pace of work at an Amazon warehouse as more and more they're turning around these items faster and faster.
Right. There have been a number of investigative reports, both from ProPublica and BuzzFeed News and several other outlets about actually deaths that have happened. These trucks are looking at an app. These drivers are, you know, under tremendous pressure to deliver these packages to people in one day or less, and they don't know where they're going. There's not the same protections in place as like UPS has. So, for example, UPS designs their routes in order for drivers to minimize the number of left turns that they have to make because those are particularly dangerous, right? However, Amazon doesn't have those kinds of protections. Their critics say that they are optimizing for speed. You know, they're optimizing for getting this done as fast as possible. Also, being a UPS driver is a relatively good job. Some of these are union jobs. They're full-time jobs, whereas a lot of these delivery jobs for Amazon are contracted positions. They're with these smaller popped-up delivery agencies. So you're not actually employed by Amazon. So Amazon isn't liable when one of these trucks hits someone or, you know, damages property or something like that. It's actually through one of these contractors. But Amazon helps these contractors set up those businesses. So they're not, you know, really independent logistics companies. They're companies that were founded by entrepreneurs who got support initially from Amazon. They might wear Amazon uniforms. They might have Amazon-branded trucks. They might have gotten actually investment money from Amazon to start that business. So they're not liable for that, but they are really, you know, reliant on those contractors, and they helped bring those contractors into existence.
On the consumer side of things, I understand, and I think you wrote about this, there's some confusion about when they say one day or 2 day delivery, 1 day or 2 days from when.
Right. It's from when your order was fulfilled. So there's kind of confusion about, like, it's not necessarily when you click ship, right? And there's kind of a lot of confusing signals on Amazon's website between, like, okay, this is a Prime item. Will this really come in 2 days? Or this is one-day shipping? So they kind of haven't figured out exactly what's going on there. And I think part of it is that when you buy an item from Amazon, it's not necessarily coming from one of their warehouses. Right. It could be coming from a third party seller who's doing their own logistics. So, you know, we've all gotten an Amazon package, or a lot of people have gotten Amazon packages and they're like, oh, this doesn't have Amazon's branding on it. There's a lot of different moving parts. So there is kind of, you know, confusion on the consumer side about, can I really guarantee that this is going to be here for the thing that I need it for?
How are Amazon's competitors, many of them big box stores with an online presence, how are they responding to the ever faster shipping promises from Amazon?
So the biggest one, of course, is Walmart, and they've also said that they're also going to do one-day shipping for lots of items. I think you also see retailers like Walmart and others really investing in their categories that Amazon can't compete on right now. So, for example, Walmart is going to really emphasize their fresh produce in their stores now. They're kind of revamping all their organic food offerings because that's something that, for now, people don't usually buy on Amazon. So I think that they're kind of trying to push further into the areas where they are doing better and at the same time say, we're also going to give you, you know, similarly fast shipping.
We see all of this if we're shopping online on a computer screen. What is happening in the world of infrastructure and the buildings and things like that that has to happen to make that a reality that we, unless we drive by on the right highway, I guess, might never see?
It is an incredible machine that Amazon has. I've actually visited one of their fulfillment centers. One of the most interesting things is that the items are not actually stored by category. So you don't walk in and there's not like a section where all the shampoo bottles are. Actually, everything is randomly organized. And there are these incredible robotic systems that help the workers who work in those warehouses alongside the robots know where those items are. There are incredible algorithms and machines that help the workers do that work. But the downside of that is that they are incredibly highly monitored. And if they don't pick a certain number of packages in an hour, they can be penalized for that. So it's a very surveilled workforce inside these warehouses, and it's a very futuristic workplace.
Now, we can't predict the future, but I mean, it seems like Amazon is growing and competitors are rushing to keep up and new businesses are just, I guess, hoping that Amazon doesn't get into their line of work. What are you watching for with ever faster shopping in the future?
Almost a year ago, I wrote a story just trying to chronicle everything that Amazon does, and I actually found it really difficult and time-consuming because they really have kind of pushed their tentacles into so many different industries. I think that online shopping is definitely the future, but I am sort of skeptical. People still want to pick up their tomato, right? They still want to choose between the broccoli heads, right? I think that there's still a lot of room here, and right now, Amazon is dominating online retail. However, they are a small part of the overall retail ecosystem in the country. And I think for a lot of consumers, $119 a year for a Prime membership is still kind of a lot. So it kind of really puts it in perspective. They're gigantic. I think that they are an incredible force in our economy, but they're also still a small part of retail. And a lot of people like to go into stores and, you know, try on that shirt before they buy it still.
And what are you watching for to see if one-day shipping actually pays off for Amazon as they put, $800 million or so dollars into it?
So it'll be very obvious. So Amazon historically has gone through these cycles where they spend a lot of money and then their profits are incredibly high. And then they spend a lot of money again and then their profits are incredibly high again. They really like to reinvest those profits into new endeavors. So I think what we'll see is, do their profits go up again?
Louise, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Louise Metzakis is a journalist reporting on technology and the internet. She's a staff writer at Wired and an on-air contributor at CBS News. She joined us to talk about the impact of Amazon's next-day shipping that's happening with more and more items in more and more places. A new lawsuit is challenging part of Wisconsin's voter ID law that sets the rules for what types of identification students can use at the polls on Election Day. The suit is being brought by the Andrew Goodman Foundation. That's a nonprofit that promotes voting among young people. It claims that the state's restrictions on using student IDs violates the 26th Amendment. Wisconsin's voter ID law is also the subject of two other legal challenges currently awaiting rulings in the court system. Barry Burden is a professor of political science and director of the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison. Barry, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
We've talked with you and others about voter ID in the state a lot over the years. What are the specific parts about whether someone can use their student ID as their voting ID?
We have been talking about this for a long time. It's quite a saga that dates back to at least 2011 when this law went into effect or when it was enacted. But it has been on hold for much of that time in the courts. The lawsuit the complaint that was filed this week is a new twist, complaining that the application of student IDs is particularly problematic. Their complaint is that students are treated differently from other voters under the law because students not only need to show an ID, but they need to provide additional documentation that other voters do not. In particular, their ID needs to have a date of issuance, which none of the other IDs require. And students must show proof of enrollment of some kind, which, of course, other non-students don't need to show. So their complaint is largely that students are being treated unfairly by having these extra burdens placed on them.
If I'm a student, could I just use a driver's license instead of even needing to bother with my student ID and that extra rigmarole?
Yeah, for many students, a driver's license is going to work. That's going to be the most common ID for all voters, but it has to be a Wisconsin driver's license, and there are some rules about how long it can be expired. But for many students, that ID is fine, and then the address on the license does not need to match the address where they're residing for college. But without the license, often students will turn to the student ID as the next best option, and that's where the rub.
So why would this be subject to a legal challenge on these extra certifications needed to use that student ID?
Well, about 2.5 years ago, there was a case decided in the Western District Court in Madison by James Peterson, and that dealt with lots of aspects of the law and some other changes to election laws, but it didn't deal with this provision. This treatment of students wasn't dealt with in the lawsuit at all. That decision was then appealed to the Seventh Circuit in Chicago, and believe it or not, the case has been sitting there for 2.5 years without a ruling. So while we await that court to do something, and they've had arguments about the case, just not issued a decision, the Andrew Goodman Foundation this week and Common Cause a few months ago both filed suit just about the student portion and these extra requirements on students. The Common Cause case argued that students' First Amendment and 14th Amendment rights were violated. The Goodman case, which you mentioned, argues that it violates the 26th Amendment, which has to do with lowering of the voting age. So slightly different constitutional arguments, but really both cases, both complaints are zeroing in on the same aspect of the law that's bugging these groups and that was not dealt with in the case 2.5 years ago.
Now, in a case like this, what has to be proven? Does it have to prove that there is intent to prevent younger people from voting in the same numbers?
Well, I'm not a judge, but I don't think intent is required. I think it's effect, that the law in effect is violating or jeopardizing the constitutional rights of students. Again, depending on which case it is, it's either which complaint it is, it's either the First and 14th Amendments or the 26th. And so a judge would have to be convinced by the evidence that would be presented at trial if these go forward in a courtroom, that students' voting rights are actually being infringed because of these additional requirements and that the state does not have a good reason for imposing them, that requiring an issuance date and a proof of enrollment doesn't really solve a problem that the state is facing. So that will be the defense that the state has to offer. What's the rationale for these requirements?
I know there's been research out there trying to figure out if voter ID laws overall change the extent to which people vote, the voter participation rates. Is there research on how they've changed the voting rates for students in particular?
There's not been much. It's an amazingly difficult problem to study. There's no list of students in the country or even in Wisconsin that someone could get who wanted to do these kinds of studies. We do know that young people are less likely to have the kinds of ID that are required by the law in Wisconsin and in other states. We also know those young people tend to move more often and so are just less rooted in a place, and that might require them to get new ID. We obviously have many out-of-state students whose driver's licenses from other states wouldn't apply under the law. So there is more of a challenge for students to get ID than other voters simply because they're younger and less likely to possess the kinds of ID already that would be acceptable under the law.
Talking to Barry Burden, professor of political science and director of the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison, looking at this new federal lawsuit, the second kind of along these lines, challenging the part of Wisconsin's voter ID law that deals with student IDs, college student IDs, says, yeah, you can use those as your voter photo ID with a couple asterisks there, an expiration date on that ID and some additional certification that the voting student is actually attending college. This is a lawsuit against a state law in a federal court. Do we know if other states have tackled the student ID issue similarly?
It's a great question. There's a tremendous amount of variation across the states in what they require of voters generally and of students in particular. I think the most common pattern is actually for states not to require any documentation at all of voters on election day. They assume that voters have already shown where they live when they registered to vote and had proof of residence. And so on election day, in many states, a voter simply signs a poll book or announces their name and is looked up in a poll book. And that was the system in Wisconsin until about 8 years ago when this law was passed. But since then, a number of states have really enacted, I would say, stricter or more demanding voter ID laws. Some of them allow student IDs to be used in one way or another. In some cases, it's only IDs from public universities, not from private. That's not the case in Wisconsin, but it is in a few other places. But there are states that don't allow student IDs at all. So Wisconsin sort of falls in the middle of the group of states that have some of the strictest requirements, in that it's a small number of IDs that are accepted in Wisconsin, but student IDs are one of them. But as you say, with an asterisk or two attached, that makes it a little more complicated for students.
The foundation that's bringing this lawsuit is funded in part by a Democratic group called Priorities USA. Voter ID laws passed by Republicans in Wisconsin and many other states. Has this just become a straight up partisan issue, voter ID?
Unfortunately, it really has. And, you know, it was not an issue at all 20 years ago. It wasn't that it wasn't a partisan one. It was not one that anyone talked about. And there were no states that had laws like this on the books. But that has changed pretty radically, I would say, since the Bush v. Gore decision following the 2000 election. It was after that election that I think partisans became aware of election laws and other practices that affected the outcome of elections. It was a controversial Supreme Court case. And then some federal legislation that followed that actually created kind of the conditions for voter ID laws to be enacted in some states. And very shortly thereafter, Indiana and Georgia and some other places enacted stricter laws. And it's become popular with Republican legislators and increasingly unpopular with Democratic legislators. And so you get this sort of back and forth, especially in swing states like ours, where party control can flip with the parties tugging back and forth on what the ID requirements are.
The stated intent of voter ID laws is to prevent fraud at the voting place. Do we have any kind of data on whether it's had that kind of impact?
We don't. We do have data on how much voter fraud was happening before the law went into effect, and the answer is extremely little. The kind of voter fraud that an ID law prevents is voter impersonation, so someone acting like someone else. That's why the ID card needs to have a photo on it. The poll worker is supposed to compare that photo to the person who's in front of them if they're voting in person. But that turns out to be one of the rarest kinds of voter fraud or election fraud or shenanigans of any kind. And so in my view, the law is sort of missing the point and not targeting the areas of the election system that we know have some vulnerabilities, and instead focusing on this pretty exceptional and I would say very risky kind of voter crime.
As you mentioned, one case on Wisconsin's voter ID law has been languishing in a federal court for some time. Now we have these two new challenges on the student angle. Have we seen any significant court rulings lately that affect us one way or the other when it comes to voter ID?
In Wisconsin, no. We've been waiting on the Seventh Circuit to say something about the case that came out of the Western District here in Madison. And so the law has largely been in effect. It was really in effect for the first time fully in 2016 for the presidential primary in April and then for the general election in November. It has now survived through the midterm elections and some other special elections and off-year elections. And so we're looking to 2020 as the next presidential cycle where, unless something happens in the Seventh Circuit, the law as it stands now will still be in effect.
And this lawsuit that we mentioned pertaining to the student ID portion of it, that's just one little nibble at the voter ID issue. Whatever comes out of that, it's probably not going to have an impact on the overall voter ID requirements. Do I have that right?
Yes, unless there's something to surprise us on the horizon, we should expect that most aspects of the voter ID law are going to be just the same in 2020 as they were last year in the 2018 elections and 2 years before that in the previous presidential election. These two cases, the Common Cause complaint and the Goodman Foundation complaint that came out this week, are really just about the student piece because they believe they have a good argument to make about students being treated differently from other voters, and that this was something that wasn't dealt with in the prior suit that came out of the Western District.
Barry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Barry Burden, professor of political science and director of the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison. He talked with us about a lawsuit challenging the state's rules on what types of student IDs can be used for identification at the polls and extra material that needs to go along with them. If you have voted as a college student with your ID, we'd love to hear from you. Email ideas@WPR.org. Two fun facts. According to music industry experts, vinyl albums are on the verge of outselling CDs for the first time since 1986. And today marks the anniversary of Thomas Edison unveiling his first version of the phonograph, which used not vinyl, but a tinfoil cylinder to capture the sound. On the frontiers of retro music technology, here's producer Tim Peterson. Tim, I understand you are a vinyl music listener.
I am, from time to time, Rob.
Yeah, so is your collection 90% vinyl? Do you have a ratio, CDs, vinyl, downloads, whatever? Tinfoil,
don't
cylinder?
Download a whole lot. Don't use tinfoil. I would say records probably have about 100.
And now, was this a now, some people really make a conscious decision, like, I'm going to be a vinyl person. Was it for you?
It wasn't. I think they started off as souvenirs from concerts that I would go to, something I thought I would actually listen to more than once, but especially something I thought maybe also had a fun cover that I would like to display while I'm listening to it.
Now, there was a stretch of time when CDs took over, and the people who were in vinyl were really smart, because you could get these guys for like a quarter at used record stores. Are you able to find bargains still on vinyl records?
I can still find bargains. In fact, in Madison, I found a copy of West Side Story for free.
Wow, that's a deal.
Yep, no, great deal.
All right, and we'll do our Jets and Sharks dance while we go out to the news. Thanks, Tim. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.